Welcome back to Plot Pit, forging fiction from fact and folklore. William Atkinson here with
John LeMay.
And today we have the final episode in a three-part author trilogy. Good things must eventually come to an end, but let's make it a good one. Declan Finn is on the phone. Hello, Declan. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
All right, John, what have you got for us today?
In the words of that Greek guy from the History Channel, it's aliens.
Aliens, folks. Let's begin the descent. John, kick us off.
So today's episode, being lazy again, I'm pulling from Noe Torres and I's book, Real Cowboys and Aliens, Early American UFOs, which covered airship sightings and extraterrestrial phenomena between the years 1800 and 1864. I was kind of struck one day as I was perusing the chapters. I found three in a row that kind of reminded me of the Ridley Scott movie Prometheus. And I'm not a fan of trying to propagate the whole ancient alien engineering thing. That's not what I want to do today. But I'm just stating it kind of reminded me of that, you know, because Prometheus is about a big ship that they find on an alien planet. And there's this mysterious goo. And I found three articles that have all of those elements. And maybe we can play with them in a different sort of way in the early 1800s. Our first story comes from April 8th, 1813, and it involved a ship at sea sighting this big, huge, well, back in their day, they didn't think about UFOs or USOs, which are unidentified submersible objects in the water. They just thought of it as a sea monster, but it really seemed to be more like a huge craft of some kind, because it was basically like this giant, kind of like a giant clamshell just floating in the ocean. And it kind of had some attributes to it that seemed mechanical or artificial as opposed to just a giant shell, and it was gigantic. So quoting from the original article, it says, "Arriving at once on deck, Captain Ardanza beheld a shining object in the sea no more than about 50 feet away on the starboard side. It was cigar-shaped. He estimated its length at about 105 to 110 feet. It had a powerful blue and white glow, made no noise whatsoever, and left no wake in the water. There was no sign of any periscope, or railing, or tower, or superstructure. In other words, no external control surfaces or protruding parts." And the story, I'm looking here, the story was called The Sea Mammoth, and it says it was published in the June 23rd, 1813 edition of the Natchez Gazette, although the story itself took place back in April. And I guess all the witnesses signed an affidavit as to the authenticity of the sighting, which included the ship's captain.
Oh, wow. I mean, that holds up in a legal scenario.
Yeah. And again, they said it looked like a large lump on the horizon at first, about 8 miles away. It resembled a great ship turned upside down, or as they put it, the hull of a large ship bottom upwards. As they got closer, the men began to think that it was a massive fish or sea monster, which they estimated to be 200 feet in length and 30 feet wide. Okay, and then the article concluded by stating that as the men got closer for a better inspection, they were, quote, deterred from the dreadful appearance of the monster, having approached within 30 yards of it. So Noe and I in our book kind of looked at this as opposed to a sea monster as being kind of like a big, huge craft, maybe kind of like the Nautilus from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or perhaps a USO alien type object of some kind.
Yeah, when you started that, my head instantly went to steampunk and Jules Verne.
Yeah, and so the other article that I'm going to link to it also takes place in the year 1813. And again, you know, we kind of described this craft as being shell-like. There was also a very odd UFO sighting in the skies of Portsmouth, Virginia, again, July of 1813, where they witnessed what looked kind of like a flying turtle shell, as opposed to just a common UFO. They literally described it as a flying turtle shell. And the witness actually wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson about this, back when Thomas Jefferson was involved with the American Philosophical Society, which sometimes would investigate these strange things. And I'll read a few little excerpts from this letter. So some of the relevant portions of this letter state that, quote, "In the south, a ball of fire, fully as large as the sun at meridian, suddenly appeared. It seemed to be kind of like obscured or belching smoke. It was, quote, frequently obscured within the space, often minutes, by a smoke emitted from its own body, but ultimately retained its brilliancy and form during that period, but with apparent agitation. It then assumed the form of a turtle, which also appeared much agitated, as frequently obscured by a similar smoke." So it's just interesting We got this big shell-like craft in the ocean, shell-like turtle, UFO flying through the stars. And now we're going to jump ahead to the year 1819, and we're going to deal with some weird goo from outer space. So back in the early 1800s, they had a phenomena that they called star rot or star jelly. It was a translucent to grayish white gelatinous substance that would often be found in the wake of meteor sightings. And no one was ever able to prove that this strange substance came from a meteor necessarily, but it would always show up after the meteor showers. So people just tended to think that they were related. And I'm going to read about an account from Amherst, Massachusetts from August of 1819. It says, on that evening between 8 and 9 o'clock, a brilliant ball of white light resembling burnished silver crashed into the ground, kind of similar to a meteor. But what makes the case unusual is the witness claimed that the ball of light actually slowed down as it descended. So that gives it kind of an alien aspect. So the witness's name was Erastus Dewey. And it says in the article, quote, "The next day, on the morning of August 14th, the aforementioned Erastus Dewey walked out of his front door to find a mass of strange goo 20 feet away in his yard. Upon learning of the incident, a chemist, Professor Rufus Graves, came onto the scene to investigate. And he was immensely interested in the meteor's touchdown point. It says about 20 feet from the front of the house, a substance unlike anything before observed by anyone who saw it was found. The situation in which it was found being exactly in the direction in which the luminous body was first seen, the luminous body being the meteor, UFO, whatever it was. This substance, when first seen by the writer, was entire, no part of it having been removed. It was in a circular form, resembling a sauce or salad dish bottom upwards, about 8 inches in diameter, and something more than one in thickness, of a bright buff color, with a fine nap upon it similar to that on milled cloth, which seemed to defend it from the action of the air. On removing the villous coat, a buff-colored, pulpy substance of the consistence of good soft soap, of an offensive suffocating smell appeared, and on near approach to it, or when immediately over it, the smell became almost insupportable, producing nausea and dizziness. A few minutes exposure to the atmosphere changed the buff into a livid cover resembling blood." And what does that remind us of? A blob, the color of blood. Reminds us of the blob from the 1957 movie, which also came from outer space. So I thought that was interesting. So we've got basically a couple of UFOs and some strange space slime in the early 1800s. And we can either set this story in the 1800s, or we can just use that as the jumping point, maybe 200 years later if we want, you know, just this is our gestation period for the story. What do you think?
So we are ending the fact and folklore section and going into the fiction part of the show. Declan, what have you got?
Unfortunately, most things I've got come up with some variation on, well, the blob. The more interesting part, I thought, was the quote-unquote clamshell below the surface of the water and in the sky. If we're going for what probably happened, I wouldn't bet against just plain, gee, lights in the sky. We've got so many of those, and even under natural phenomenon. However, since we're not playing with real life, yeah, like I said, I found the clam-shaped spaceship more interesting. And let's face it, if it's airtight enough to go into space, it's airtight enough to go under the water. Now, the question there becomes, is it in the water because it's, you know, like Star Trek IV, talking to something in the water? Or is it just a matter of, yeah, we want to stay out. We want to stay out of the way, so we're going to stay as deep as possible without anyone noticing. Unless, of course, you want to go into H.P. Lovecraft and, yes, Cthulhu is under the sea. Which makes that one song mean something very different.
Well, I have to say, I actually picked this out last week because our guest author was deep into Cthulhu, and we decided we were going to do something different. So that was for Griff. So this was originally meant for him. So that's funny that you caught on to the Cthulhu thing.
I'm going to take a little bit onto the cosmic horror scenario of this. I want to tie it to 2012 in the Mayan calendar. Okay. And
oh, that would be 100 years later, too, from 1813.
Yes.
Or, I mean, yeah, 200 years later. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to also turn this into a bit of a cosmic horror scenario. Mm-hmm. And we are going to just drop into and pad this and bathe it a little bit with the whole theory of global warming. Now, here's what's going on. The solar system during the 1800s, going into the 1900s, and crossing 2012, the solar system was crossing the galactic plane. Mm. So what we've got then, theoretically, a very talented author could bathe that galactic plane with all sorts of electromagnetic radiation, which would increase global temperatures, and the blob, if you were to think about the Earth as a living organism that's being cooked in an oven, like salmon. If you overcook salmon, a bunch of that white stuff comes up onto the surface.
Okay. Interesting.
And so that's that goo.
Okay. It's, so it didn't come from the stars. It came from the Earth. Okay.
And the Earth being a living organism, Mother Earth and all of that, if you want to play in that realm, we are crossing the galactic plane cosmically, and Mother Earth is getting cooked literally. And now I don't know how to fit all of the clamshells and stuff into this or the...
Well, maybe we don't have to. We always jump off with like three. That's just kind of our rule, but we don't have to. We could just run with the goo and that's it.
And so 2012, we've crossed the galactic plane, right? 100 years later. And the early symptoms was this goo, right? Coming up and out.
Should the goo come to life and eat people or what should it do?
I don't know. We're not 1950s now.
Yeah.
Well, you got several options, because one, the clamshells could be coming for the goo, because, oh, look, this, I don't care if the goo eats people, I don't care if it's just sitting there, but gee, alien life forms see it, and oh, look, it's fuel, it's food, or if you want to go for that very weird 80s movie, I Come in Peace, they can make it into drugs, because... everyone's going to have a drug dealer somewhere in the galaxy.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, you remember that one now.
Actually, I don't remember that movie, but this sparks an idea that I tossed in a previous episode of Jupiter and Shoemaker-Levy 9, where when the comet strikes Jupiter, it's actually cracking the shell of the intergalactic egg for a cosmic dragon.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
So,
a good memory.
If we want to really bathe this into the ultra monster movie or ultra monster story, right? The setting is the galactic cosmos, and humans are like just mites living on an egg that's hatching. And this is all the stuff coming out, and we don't realize it, but it's actually like Hollow Earth theory. So, going back to Admiral Byrd, okay? And on the inside is a living cosmic creature that's about to emerge.
That was the only thing I liked about that Marvel movie they just did. Starts with an E?
Eternals.
Yeah, the Eternals. That was the only concept I liked in the Eternals, was that the plot was a cosmic being is being birthed through the Earth's destruction. That was the only thing I thought was cool or salvageable about that movie. So I love that concept.
Okay.
I
just, for our listeners, I don't pay attention to anything in the comic book world or Marvel, DC, none of it. So that is brand new to me. Like, I do not watch those movies. The only time I will is if somebody, over the course of a couple of years, I get like two or three recommendations. And the last one that actually happened with was The Joker. I actually watched The Joker. I thought it was really good movie. But The Eternals, I didn't even know that it existed. So
it's like their most despised movie Marvel ever did. It's their big dud. So that's probably part of it. But
so just for everybody, I did not pull the cosmic monster out of that. But there you go. You could have like this cosmic monster, and that's or Shoemaker-Levy 9 hits Jupiter, and that's cracking the cosmic dragon shell, and Earth is just the morsel that the mother dragon left lying around.
Yeah.
And we're about to get eaten.
Could be. And if you really want to go the Mayan, you really want to keep doing the Mayan 2012 thing, then you say it's the rebirth of Quetzalcoatl, the dragon, and that could fit in too.
Now, we've done Quetzalcoatl on the show.
A lot.
Yeah, a lot. Now, I'm not like specifically trying to tie it back into that. I was just thinking about the 2012 thing and crossing the galactic plane, and all the electromagnetic radiation was warming the Earth. So we've got a couple of ideas here of where to take this from the starting point of the story. Declan, what do you want to run with?
Oh, I'm good with cosmic dragons. It's just a matter of how do you... I'm not even thinking of how do you fight this. It's more a matter of how do you dissuade it from destroying everything. Then again, do we want the cosmic dragon to come out of the planet Earth? And yes, all this slime is just byproduct of, it's getting ready to hatch. Granted, ready is relative when you're got a, 65 billion year incubation period?
Yeah, so the setting of the story would be the universe as opposed to the Earth, right?
Yeah, it would kind of have to be.
And you could pop in and out in the narrative of the perspective of Earthlings and then the perspective of the cosmic order of things. Mm. And one of the things that Neil Reby had in that book, I Shall Not Mate, was the idea of a sentient volcano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or no, I'm sorry.
Vistakill, his book Vistakill.
Correct. Vistakill, a sentient volcano. So the point of view here is very unique if we were to run with the cosmic dragon idea and kind of a sentient universe or a sentient solar system.
Or, well, now you've got me off in another direction. Now I'm thinking, you know, sometimes they do think that comets and meteors can carry
microorganisms.
Microorganisms. So how about the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs had one of those little tiny life forms on it, and killing all the dinosaurs, it absorbs all of its traits somehow, then it burrows into the Earth, and then that's it. That's how it came here. So the Earth wasn't really an egg, but it got made into like kind of like a cocoon or something.
Okay, so let's, one of my favorite phrases, etch a sketch away the cosmic idea, the cosmic dragon. We'll come back to that in another episode when we figure that one out. however, the primordial ooze.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so these comets are like seeding the Earth billions of years ago, and those microorganisms, they, for whatever reason, ate on the dead carcasses of all of the material that had died because of the collision, absorbed down into the Earth, and then over the course of, you know, the several hundred thousand years or whatever, evolution has taken place, and now the primordial ooze is bubbling back up to the surface, and we're about to hit another evolutionary spurt of new creatures and, I don't know, humans evolving.
Or aliens are sending the goo to Earth via meteorites to mutate humanity away from their God-given destiny.
Okay. That too. I like that.
And Declan, what do you think? You could etch-a-sketch the whole thing and just come up with something totally new off of those ideas from before.
Well, you were talking about our galaxy crossing the interstellar plane earlier, and all I could think was tying it into another event in the 1800s called the Carrington Event, which was basically our sun went weird and sent out an EMP for like 3 days, since we didn't have a lot of electronics. The only reason we know about it is because it started interrupting communications and telegraphs at the time. So that's step one, because, oh, look, you know, we may have picked up a few interstellar hitchhikers that inhabit the plane. So, and they planted something along the way and nobody noticed because, hey, look, Carrington's vent screws up communications. Nobody can exactly tell everyone else what's going on. And let's face it, you wipe out a town or two, who's going to notice, even if it was the blob that wiped them out. And, oh, look, it's got a 170-year gestation period. And, yes, something's about to be born. I still like the space dragon idea. I don't care if it's currently gestating in the core of the planet, or it's just going to, you know, emerge from Mount Fuji, which, yeah, how's that? Okay, but you don't even, basic kaiju that literally gestates in a molten core. It's like, yeah, good luck nuking that. Good luck shooting that.
Exactly, yeah. So maybe like the blob, you'd have to freeze it or something.
Like the blob, you'd have to freeze it. Again, with the blob substance, I'm quite happy for.
Ooh.
Yes, it is a byproduct of this thing gestating in the core, and it comes up through the cracks.
I got it. I got it. And I can tie in the aliens now.
Okay.
You've got this microorganism, the gestation period, whatever, that causes the kaiju to grow inside the molten core.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to kill it is to freeze the blob. Now, maybe it's the egg yolk or something. I don't know all of that. But the only way that you can actually freeze that amount of goo is to instigate an ice age.
Mm-hmm. So the ice age killed the first one that came with the dinosaurs. Now we're onto the one that came in 1819, and you've got to kill it with a new ice age. Is that it?
And the aliens know how to do this, and that's what they're doing with those shell-shaped objects.
Okay, cool.
They're literally seeding the planet with the means to turn the globe into an ice cube, effectively, which instigates our ice age, which then explains past ice ages and mass extinction events. And the aliens exist in a much longer time frame than the human lifespan, which is why in 1800s, right, we're seeing certain things, but we haven't fully, we don't have the lifespan to see the long-term effects of it. And so it's like news to us today, whereas, you know, the aliens are looking at it as, say, a 300-400 year process.
And the reason it didn't pop up in the 1800s was Krakatoa, which dropped the entire planetary temperature by, what, 10 degrees, I think? Well, we're still coming out of the mini ice age that created.
So we have the instigating event. We know what the conflict is. The aliens are trying to kill off this kaiju.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do we finish it? I think we did. The instigation of the ice age. Now, the question then with this story is, do we tell it from the perspective of humans and then do like a 3-book trilogy where you've got, say, the 1800s viewpoint, the 1900s, 2000s viewpoint, and then say 300 years into the future, and a family line that spans all of this? Or do we want to tell it from the perspective of the aliens and do it, say, in a 1-book or a 2-book series with the pop in, pop out, and maybe the aliens discover, oh, there is sentient life on this planet. How do we save humanity and still kill the kaiju?
I think it should have a really depressing ending where the monster just cracks out of the earth, and it's kind of like one of those Planet of the Apes where the ending's real dark and glum, and that's it.
Declan?
Well, I am more fond of doing it from the human point of view because, one, it looks a hell of a lot more hopeless, and you have to fight your way up. You have to fight your way uphill on that one. Also, if you're doing it from the point of view of aliens, it becomes a lot more complicated because you've got to develop the entire alien culture, the entire alien thought process, and I am not usually fond of downer endings. Although you say Planet of the Apes, all I could think is, did Charlton Heston not recognize the moon?
Ooh, good point. Yeah.
It's like, wait, the apes speak English, they're riding Earth horses, and oh yeah, you're an astronaut. You should be able to recognize the moon, right?
Yeah.
But that's nitpicking. But with this, it's a lot of uphill battles, and how long does it take humans to realize, A, there is a problem, and B, you know, how long does it take for them to figure out how to stop it? Because, yeah, we don't even need an ice age. It's Terminator 2. Welcome to liquid nitrogen.
Ooh, fair. Good thought. Yeah, that could be the human scientist. He wants to create liquid nitrogen, and so then maybe he's in conflict with the aliens and the monster that way.
Yes, because if the aliens have decided, yeah, we don't want this thing to get off your planet and come to ours, so we're just going to pretend that we're making an interstellar highway through your planet, and just wipe you all out, just to be sure. And yeah, fighting is a 3-way fight between humans, aliens, and kaiju number 3. That sounds like a party, because yeah. Once you get rid of the kaiju, because let's face it, that's going to be the easy part once you discover, oh, look, it's too cold, it dies. Yeah, liquid nitrogen's easy. The problem then becomes, oh, look, yeah, you've gotten rid of the kaiju, But the aliens still want to be sure. So now what? So we've got at least three books out of it, just doing the generational thing, following one family, as you suggested. And I don't know if you want to do book four. How do we deal with the agent? How do we deal with the alien exterminators who are pissed that we did their job for them?
I think that's the cash grab sequel that you just shouldn't do. No, I think just one book is probably enough. I thought we were just going to do a quaint little Victorian era version of the Blob, but this was way bigger than I ever expected, so that's interesting.
Thank you, Shoemaker Levy 9. Okay, well, there we go. I think that's the end of this episode. It has been an absolute blast on the phone here with Declan Finn, author of several books. Declan, thank you again for your time. Now, you've got the space opera series out, you've got your Tommy series out, and then the vampire series. Give us just the last little bit on that.
Well, the vampire series will be coming shortly from Three Ravens Press. It's the Love at First Bite quartet. Hopefully soon to be followed by Honeymoon from Hell. St. Tommy NYPD is 12 books long, a lot of horror elements in urban fantasy, and also a lot of, we're going to punch demons in the face now. And White Ops, the space opera, starts off by, we're going to take out the cannibalistic hordes from the next galaxy over, and then spirals.
Do you have Audible books by chance?
Not yet. We are working on them. I have, both publishers are trying to find the perfect voice because, good God, nobody wants to listen to me for 15 hours. I don't want to listen to me for 15 hours.
Fair enough. Give us your socials.
My socials are Declan Finn Books on Twitter. I think it's just plain Declan Finn Author over at Facebook. And, I can be found pretty much on any social media platform, DeclanFinn.substack, DeclanFinn.com, if that works. It may not. Blogger has been giving me a pain. And I try to show up on every social media platform as soon as it arrives. Yes, even some of the ones that are weird, except for BitChute. BitChute doesn't like me. I don't like it. And I have to, may have to get my wife, the programmer, to tell me exactly how to work it.
You've been listening to Plot Pit, Forging Fiction from Fact and Folklore. We have ended our three-part author trilogy today with Declan Finn. William Atkinson here with
John LeMay.
And again, Declan, thank you for your time today. It's been an absolute blast.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Next week, another special guest. Stay tuned. We'll announce that soon on our Twitter account. Soon, Twitch, at Plot Pit. We have a YouTube channel. We're going to be putting some stuff out there. If you are interested in being on the show for any reason, if you want to make submissions, just have your stuff read over the air, send us an email, submissions@plotpit.com, and we'll catch you around.